I'm John Strum, and this is Real Talk MS. It's October 3rd, and we have a lot to talk about. And today, we're talking about what you and your doctor should be talking about. Dr. Liliana Amezcua is joining me to share her thoughts on the kinds of conversations you should be having with your neurologist or MS specialist. Shared decision-making is a key component of patient-centered healthcare. It's a process in which clinicians and patients work together to make evidence-based decisions on tests, treatments, and care plans that balance risks and expected outcomes with patient preferences and values. Now, compare everything you just heard me say with the experience of being handed a bunch of pamphlets from different pharmaceutical companies and being told to read them and get back to your doc about which drug therapy you'd like to start. So how do we bridge the gap between the promise of shared decision-making and what, for too many people living with MS, is still an unfortunate reality? Dr. Amezcua is an associate professor of neurology, a diversity, equity, and inclusion champion, and the fellowship program director at the University of Southern California Keck School of Medicine. Dr. Amezcua also serves as a principal investigator on several clinical research projects, and her research interests include defining racial and ethnic disparities and discerning modifiable environmental and sociocultural factors from non-modifiable genetic factors involved in MS severity and progression. But before we get to my conversation with Dr. Liliana Amezcua, there are a few other things that you should know about. Next week, the National MS Society is hosting the second annual Hispanic Latinx MS Experience Summit. It's taking place October 12th from 1 to 4:45 p.m. Eastern Time. The Hispanic Latinx Experience Summit is a virtual event that will give you an opportunity to hear from experts, participate in discussions about both emotional and physical wellness, and maybe most importantly, you'll have an opportunity to connect with others in the Hispanic Latinx community who were affected by MS during informal online meetups. As a matter of fact, one of the experts you'll be hearing from is Dr. Liliana Amezcua, who just happens to be my guest on today's episode of the podcast. The Hispanic Latinx MS Experience Summit is an opportunity to share stories and explore common experiences of living with MS. Whether you happen to live with MS or you have a loved one who lives with MS, you'll leave the summit with stronger connections to the information, support, and people who can make your life with MS better in the coming year. It all takes place on October 12th from 1 to 4:45 p.m. Eastern Time, and there's no cost to participate. If you're looking for more information or you're ready to register for the Hispanic Latinx MS Experience Summit, you'll find a link in today's show notes, and I'd recommend registering even if you can't make it to the live online event. By registering, you'll have access to session recordings and resources in English and Spanish. A few weeks ago, I told you that the FDA had approved Tyruko, a biosimilar for Tysabri. And today I can report that the European Medicines Agency has also approved Tyruko for use throughout the European Union. Like Tysabri, Tyruko has been approved by the EMA for treating relapsing-remitting MS in adults with highly active disease. Tyruko is the first biosimilar to be approved for treating MS. And if you'd like to learn more about biosimilars, you'll want to catch my conversation with Dr. Jiwon Oh, in episode number 315 of Real Talk MS, and you'll find a link to that episode in today's show notes. Study results from Spain provide evidence that the COVID-19 mRNA vaccines, those are the vaccines from Pfizer and Moderna, do not appear to worsen MS symptoms and may provide protection for at least 6 months after a booster dose. The results from the study also showed that getting vaccinated was safe and did not trigger the development of any other autoimmune diseases. This study involved 390 people with MS who were followed at two MS centers in Barcelona and received their COVID-19 vaccinations in 2021. The study also included 64 people who were living with other autoimmune diseases, and all of the study participants were followed for up to a year after being vaccinated. And to determine how each study participant's immune system responded to the COVID-19 vaccines, the research team measured the level of COVID antibodies and T cells in each study participant's blood at various times throughout the study. If you remember from those frightening days during the pandemic, a typical mRNA vaccine schedule involved two initial doses of the vaccine given 3 to 8 weeks apart, and then a booster dose given no sooner than 8 weeks after the second vaccine dose. In the study, COVID antibodies were detected in 86% of the study participants 1 month after receiving the second dose of the vaccine. 394 of the study participants received a COVID-19 booster about 6 months after being vaccinated, and 92% of those study participants still tested positive for COVID antibodies 6 months after receiving the booster. The researchers noted that, as we now would expect, study participants who were being treated with anti-CD20 therapies like Ocrevus and Gilenya had significantly lower antibodies than study participants who weren't receiving these specific disease-modifying therapies. And although 180 of the study participants did develop COVID at some point during the study, there were no severe cases, as we would also expect. These study results are particularly well-timed as COVID-19 is currently on the rise across the United States and other countries. Hospitalizations and deaths have been increasing for the past couple of months. But the good news is that there's a new COVID vaccine that's been formulated to provide protection specifically against the COVID variant that's most prevalent right now. So whether you did or didn't receive the initial COVID vaccine or a subsequent booster, you should check your health insurance coverage and schedule this new COVID vaccination along with your annual flu vaccination. You can get them both at the same time, like I did. COVID-19 has already taken more than 1.1 million American lives. That's more than a million families who are going to have an empty seat at their Thanksgiving table this year. And the evidence is in. Getting vaccinated means it's much more likely that you won't face a difficult time, even if you get COVID. So review the evidence and plan to have a great holiday season this year by getting vaccinated now. If you'd like to review the details of this study, you'll find a link in today's show notes. And whether you're thinking about the COVID-19 vaccine, your MS disease-modifying therapy, or any other aspect of your healthcare, being able to have a thoughtful conversation about your care plan with your neurologist or MS specialist is your right as a patient, and as an active and informed participant in managing your MS, it's also your responsibility. In a moment, Dr. Liliana Amezcua will join us to discuss why shared decision-making is important and how you can go about participating in shared decision-making with your healthcare provider. There are more than 20 disease-modifying therapies that have been approved by the FDA for treating multiple sclerosis. But with so many options, how do you go about choosing the right medication for you? And beyond disease-modifying therapies, an MS treatment plan will ideally reflect a holistic approach to managing MS, including lifestyle options like diet and exercise that have been shown to improve the quality of life for people living with MS. My guest today is Dr. Liliana Amezcua, and we're talking about how you can work together with your healthcare provider in shared decision-making when it comes to determining the best MS treatment plan for you. Dr. Amezcua is an associate professor of neurology, a diversity, equity, and inclusion champion, and the fellowship program director at the University of Southern California's Keck School of Medicine. Dr. Amezcua also serves as a principal investigator on multiple clinical research projects, And her research interests include defining racial and ethnic disparities and discerning modifiable from non-modifiable genetic factors involved in MS severity and progression. Welcome back to the podcast, Dr. Omeskwa.
Thank you for having me. It's always a pleasure.
I always like to begin conversations like these with a definition. So with that in mind, how would you define shared decision-making?
Shared decision-making is really the simple, well, not simple, but complex, right? Coming together of working and deciding together what's best for the patient with their provider. So it's really the provider and patient working together to make that healthcare decision that is thought to be the best for the patient.
And why is shared decision-making important for someone who's living with MS?
It's so important. One, because, you know, this is a complex disease. So it really just starts off by even just thinking about, does the patient and the physician agree, for example, on what the type of disease they have? You know, are we going to make a decision about, so we can all be on the same page, it's relapse remitting MS, let's say, and what might be the drug? We have over 20 disease modifying therapies. These drugs can be given different ways, oral infusions, right? Injections, different frequencies. And in order for us to make the best decision to come together, we need to better understand, and I'm thinking right now as a physician, right? What is important to the patient? What is important to them? Is this independence, less frequency? What is important to them so I can better provide, for example, the options, the available options that we can work together? We also need to think about safety, right? What's important for that patient? You know, and every patient is so different that one patient may actually have such extreme fear about a particular drug for a small percentage possibility of something that may happen versus others have a higher, you know, maybe call them risk takers. And so we need to sort of understand what's important to the patient so we can deliver those better options or best options. And then, of course, you know, we're always accounting evidence-based information in providing, you know, sort of the best possibilities that we think our patient would do best and be able to adhere to the treatment and also provide at the same time quality to their life.
You know, when some people with MS hear about shared decision-making, they worry that they have to become experts in all the different disease-modifying therapies so that they can present an informed opinion and make the best decision in choosing that DMT for themselves. I'm sure that's not the case, but what should that conversation sort of be about?
It's a very good question, right? What should the question, you know, sort of the conversation be about? I think it's really comes down to, you know, if we're thinking as a, you know, of a particular treatment for our patient, and you hear these stories, right? A patient is seen and is given a website to look up what drug they should choose, or they're given a flyer and say, pick one. That's really not the right thing to do, right? In my opinion, it's, you know, how can they come to a shared decision when they don't know everything about these 20 drugs? Now, I think it's really important to sort of introduce, you know, for example, several choices as a physician and, you know, an expert, we can do that. We can take consideration of their disease, their conversation, what is important. And then we can sort of say, hey, I think then based on what you've told me, I feel that these could be, you know, three options. And then we need to describe those options to the patient to see if we can actually, you know, understood. Did we actually understand correctly? So bring in the humility there to better understand, did I capture everything that my patient told me? And so then the patient can start saying, it's like, yes, actually, you know, that would be possibly a good option for me. And then if it's not, then be able to then say, okay, well, wait a minute, I didn't realize that. What about this other option? And I think that's, you know, sort of the best way to approach any type of decision that you're going to make, whether if it's for treatment or, you know, surgery or even just, you know, exploring physical therapy type of programs near them, right? Sometimes we want them to do physical therapy and you know, there's perhaps different options that are available or even locations. And we need to take in consideration those issues to make that best decision between both of us, where meaning what I recommend the patient is actually going to do because they realize this is important and they were also part of the decision making and they agree, yes, this is going to be probably a good option for me and I think I can follow.
When patients go online and Google multiple sclerosis, they can find a lot of accurate, reliable information, and they can find a lot of inaccurate and unreliable information. Very often, they run up against seeing opinion that's masquerading as fact. So what happens when they bring what may be the wrong facts or even strongly held beliefs that may rely on bad information into the clinic with them?
Well, first of all, as a physician, you should not right away say, oh, that is not true. Absolutely. You need to hear them. You need to take a step and say, oh, tell me, what do you understand about this? Oh, and then they tell you what it is. And if you, you know, don't agree with that and it's not a fact and it's not evidence-based, then you can say, where did you hear that? Where did you learn? It's that. And then you can start, you know, in my opinion, as a physician, we just need to take that first step back and hear them out and why they believe this might be true or they strongly believe that they should do such thing. Then we can say it's like, well, actually, you know, this is what the data has shown. And in my opinion and in my experience and see if you're able to, you know, to erase or at least, you know, direct them to the right place and say, well, instead, you know, you might consider also reading this. There's this website, for example, the National Society has this. So they can also be part of that sort of action, right? And, you know, in many cases, many physicians right away dismiss their perceptions or their ideas. And so then that kind of right away builds a defensive mechanism from them. It's like, well, they didn't hear me or, you know, because I strongly believe about that. And our job is really to, again, you know, it's providing them what we think is the best choice, but also directing them and providing health literacy as best as we can.
You know, so far we've focused on the patient's role in shared decision making. Let's talk about the other person in that conversation, the healthcare provider. For some healthcare providers, shared decision making is a very different approach to how they have historically treated their patients. Not every healthcare provider embraces shared decision making. Some haven't even heard of it. So what happens when a healthcare provider isn't accustomed to including their patients in treatment conversations like the ones we've been discussing? How can a patient advocate for themselves to be a part of that conversation?
Yeah, right. So many times you do, you know, you still see it, unfortunately. And perhaps, you know, some of it may be, you know, old ways of practicing medicine. And unfortunately, in many countries, it's still, you hear about it, right? It takes on this paternalistic role as a physician or healthcare provider, where you are just, you know, you just tell them what to do without any questions being asked, right? And so, that, you know, unfortunately, you know, doesn't work nowadays. And in this case, you know, if the patient is having this type of experience, well, of course, the individual, the patient that is much well armed with information, right, by, you know, keeping up with, you know, perhaps participating in webinars and in information sessions, they're going to be able to say, hey, it's like, wait, why are you giving me this? Or, you know, can you explain to me? So it's really, you know, I would say from the patient, you should be able to ask questions. You should be able to, you know, question the treatment that is being given to you. And if there's not a particular answer that is, you know, sort of, providing you the answer that you're looking for, then in many cases, sometimes, you know, this is where second opinions may be necessary, right? But, you know, again, it's really, how do we arm our patients when this may be happening, right? And it's really the top of the thing is education and learning as much as you can about the disease.
As you've seen shared decision-making play out, have you been able to identify any behavioral or cultural characteristics within any specific minority populations that might present unique challenges to shared decision-making?
Absolutely. I mean, every, you know, culture has a certain ways that they go about making decisions, right? And again, this is a complex disease or life, you know, life or death situations, right? How you make those decisions can be culturally, you know, sort of informed. And so, for example, in the Hispanic community, and, you know, one of the things that we see, and this is not just specific to MS, in my opinion, is that you see it across, is that the way that they perceive the disease may very much, you know, affect how they go about acting or reacting to, you know, how they're going to go about it, if they're going to decide on treatment or not, for example. So meaning your perception dictates in a way your behavior. We've looked at perceptions of MS, and we conducted focus groups, and you know, just the perception of disease is really a complex, multidimensional issue that involves both cognitive domains and beliefs, right? And so again, goes back to these belief systems where, you know, we understand that disease, for example, MS, there's a genetic, environmental aspects, right? What we've learned as scientists of pathophysiology. But in a community where perhaps the disease is not, you know, well known, for example, diabetes, hypertension is well known, MS is a little bit more, you know, sort of not well known, maybe now, but a couple of years it was not. And so when we think about MS and the immune system is a little abstract. And so if the belief is that it's came out of some mythological aspect, then there's less inclination to possibly go on treatment. Particularly these treatments, again, are dealing with an immune system. Immune system, again, is abstract. So it makes it much more difficult to take action. What we also learned was that family being part of that decision-making is so important. And they really, really care about how the family thinks about them, right? So, you know, one of the things that we found out was that, you know, fatigue is not really a, you know, it's associated with a taboo, just like, mental health, right? It's not visible. But what you see may look like laziness. And so it may be interpreted as laziness. And so it was really hard to validate those type of symptoms to family members. And if the family member doesn't accept it, then it's harder for them to take care of it. And so from those, you know, group discussions, we found out that if the family is accepting and they understand the disease, so meaning health literacy and health education programs really, not just need to go out to the patient, but to their caregivers and family, then they're like more likely to take on a more positive role in taking care of MS.
I've always tended to believe that chronic illness impacts families, not individuals. Of course, it impacts it impacts the patient in the most profound way, but they're not alone. It's really important to see the family and involve them, just as you've suggested. I think those are great steps that can be taken.
Exactly. And in many cases, we've said, and you know, it's not even just the Hispanic Latino community. Sometimes, you know, do you have someone, do you, you know, bring them along with you to that appointment so we can actually talk about it. I'm happy, you know, to talk to others of your family that would like to learn, or your spouse, you know, learn about MS and see, you know, how can we possibly erase some of those myths or taboos.
I want to change gears for a moment. When the Affordable Care Act was passed, we celebrated because it provided access to care for people who couldn't access care before, but it didn't solve everything. And when it comes to treating MS, we certainly know that access to care and quality of care are both incredibly important. You're the principal investigator of a study titled "The Impact of Medical Insurance on Healthcare Access and Quality for People with Multiple Sclerosis in the United States, a Scoping Review." The results of this study were just published a couple of days ago. Can you tell me about the study and what you and your team learned?
Yeah, absolutely. And I do want to give, you know, big applause to Nuriel Magavam, who is my fellow and took on this and very interested in health policy. And one of the things that we've always, you know, sort of talk about is the high cost of DMT. And certainly even within those that have, you know, insurance, and one could say, oh, this is a good insurance, we still have some barriers, and we see it all the time in the clinic, right? And sometimes you don't learn about them until you're speaking to them and you ask them, it's like, so why did you get your, you know, filled in your medication, like, you know, a month later, or you're seeing some, you know, again, adherence issues, and you find out that, you know, they were having a copay of $2,000 per month. And you don't hear about these things until you dig into. And in many cases, these patients are really trying hard to stay on their DMT, but not, we are not learning, you know, we're not realizing that they're still having to cut, you know, out of pocket cost to even just maintain that. And so, so we wanted to better understand, what do we know about, you know, sort of this issue? There have been, you know, health insurance coverage. Does the design make a difference? You know, because you do have HMO, right? And you have PPO. I mean, I myself have experienced both types. and you know, as simple as this, that, you know, when I had one child, I was under PPO and another child under HMO. And it was very different types of out-of-cost spending. So I can't imagine, you know, what our patients are having to deal with and on having to take care of, you know, their disease and having to, you know, have all these out of high cost pays monthly or every time they see us, right? And so we undertook the search and we found out that, you know, privately insured patients with multiple sclerosis were most likely to be on DMT. That makes sense. But there was this increased out-of-pocket spending, and that basically had a relationship with lower DMT adherence and discontinuation rates. What we also found was that access to specialty pharmacy programs was associated with improved DMT adherence. And that, I think it might be something to explore going forward. And we've heard this also from our neuropharmacologist at USC, where basically these programs sometimes are able to probably bypass some of the cost by, you know, again, maybe there's incentives behind it that we're trying to better understand. But certainly it seems that, you know, it doesn't matter if you have coverage. It is really sometimes the design that's going to affect, you know, you know, if you're going to have a high copay or not. Certainly we have issues with authorization requirements. I think everybody's familiar with that, right? And then also what, you know, sort of these, you know, insurances behind, you know, sometimes have certain tiers. Somebody has to fail a certain drug before they go on to a different drug. And so the step therapy issues. Well, we were not able to really well characterize those issues. We feel that moving forward, we should take a look at these issues as well, because we believe, you know, if there is a need for authorizations, that can delay care. That can delay care, not just in obtaining DMT, but also in getting an MRI, for example. And so these authorizations create, it's a barrier. It's a barrier to care. And those without authorizations, right, needing authorizations, you're able to get access more quickly. One of the things that has been shown is that, for example, overall, what does Medicare do, right? Medicare, in a way, right, provides care. What is it, 64, 65 and older, but those also with, you know, disability and a certain income. And while it is able as a whole, be able to sort of decrease health disparities, we still have an issue, right? We still have an issue. And it does decrease the health disparities because in a way it acts like a universal healthcare plan to a certain extent. And we could probably argue that, but in a way it does something. So these sort of, you know, federal programs and, you know, they are trying to mitigate. They're not perfect, but they are trying to mitigate these barriers. And of course, us as physicians or researchers in this field, we need to be able to be providing this data and address, is it closing a gap or is it creating a new gap? So it'll be interesting to see, for example, what does the Inflation Reduction Act do for our MS patients? Is it going to be helpful, or is it going to create a gap, or is it going to create another barrier? And so one needs to sort of explore all the time whenever there's new policies taking into action.
Well, just for the record, you will get no argument from me about whether Medicare is a universal health plan and whether or not that might be a good thing. So no arguments here. And yeah. I'm glad you mentioned the authorization issue. You know, a few weeks ago on this podcast, I was talking about another study that showed that the delays associated with going through that prior authorization process for a DMT that a physician and their patient had agreed upon often yes. resulted in the patient experiencing symptom worsening and even additional relapses before they finally received access to the right medication. You know, and so when you talk about it could result in a gap in care, unfortunately, absolutely. That sometimes means someone is going to unnecessarily experience a relapse.
A relapse. Exactly. I mean, we've had probably all of us can think of a story where we're waiting for the drug to be approved. There's so many delays. First, it gets, you know, rejected. Now you have to go to, you know, an appeal. The appeal gets rejected. Then you ask for a peer-to-peer. That's like a month or so, right? Patient is worsening, right? They end up in the hospital. Now it's an extra cost and a relapse and loss of function. So I think all of us have one of those stories.
Well, I think as science continues to deliver improved treatments for MS, it seems like it's incumbent on us to find ways to improve access to those treatments.
Absolutely.
Well, Dr. Liliana Amezcua, thank you for all you do in the clinic, in your research, and through your advocacy to improve the lives of people living with MS. And thanks for talking with me today.
Thank you so much, John. It's always a pleasure.
That's going to wrap up this episode of Real Talk MS. Real Talk MS is powered by the National MS Society. And you can share this episode of the podcast by letting your friends or family members know that all they have to do is point their web browser at realtalkms.com/318. You'll find that link in today's show notes, so you can easily copy and paste it right into an email or a text. And if you have a minute, I hope you'll visit the Apple App Store or the Google Play Store and download the free RealTalk MS app for your iOS or Android smartphone or tablet. It's the best way for us to stay connected. The app will automatically download the latest episode of RealTalk MS. You'll be able to access any of our past episodes. You'll be able to save your favorite episodes. And it's a great way for me to share bonus content with you. The app is free, so I hope you'll download it today. I'm John Strum. Thanks for listening. Stay safe and make healthy choices.